Being engaged around elections is like a religion in my family. It's as if voting were a religion. And you know what? In our religion, it is. Our tradition, even before we adopted a Unitarian viewpoint on God, highly valued democratic participation. Back in the day, the ministers who were paid to be the public teacher of morality, on market day, would give a lecture and would talk about what's going on politically, ethically, socially. We'd be talking about an appropriate response for us to what's going on in the world. By tradition, the sermon before election day would be a time when the ministers of our ancient tradition would assure their parishioners of the sacred power entrusted in voting. Voting in the constituted congregational sense was sacred. The congregation gathers, makes a decision, and they actually, in their voting, are discerning the will of God. And voting in the democratic sense and the civic sense is likewise our social sacrament. In the New England town meeting sense, it's a sacred action by which the will of the people is determined. So democracy is essential to us, and it's as if voting were a religion. The founders of this congregation sought to bring this New England sensibility to this boom town at the heart of this democratic nation. Proclaiming ourselves independent was independent of unnecessary structures like councils of bishops or councils of elders. But independent also allowed us to be constituted as a body that could chart its own way in the world. Independent as a congregation was a part of our religion. But being independent in our religion was a way also of being an example out in the world. The independence that we found with one another by being democratic with one another, by finding the voice of the people with one another, would be an emblem for the independence and democracy that needed to be shared out in the world. The founders of our country were political liberals, and the founders of this congregation were religious liberals. Unitarian Universalist minister Gary Kowalski, in his book, Revolutionary Spirits, The Enlightened Faith of America's Founding Fathers, shares these thoughts. A liberal is one who cherishes liberty. And freedom was never far from the founders' thoughts. In the political realm, liberalism has been the historic protector and promoter of human rights, carving out a zone of personal autonomy exempt from government intrusion or oversight. Culturally, liberals prize pluralism. A multiplicity of creeds and customs is the hallmark of a healthy society. In the spiritual domain, liberalism has been characterized by an attitude more inquisitive than inquisitorial, believing that religious truth best emerges from the free play of imagination and ideas. In all its forms, liberalism chafes against unwarranted restrictions on the human spirit. With Jefferson, who pledged eternal hostility to every tyranny over the mind of man, liberals are anti-authoritarian. They are less obedient to the claims of tradition, more receptive to improving on the past. To paraphrase historian Peter Gay, liberals fear change less than they fear stagnation. Close quote. The founding of this democratic nation required certain gifts and strategies. It was the class of merchants who sought to trade the agricultural production of the nation and the manufactured goods produced by artisans who had discovered that they were fetters to their own development, that the development as colonials was always going to be fettered, taxed by a parliament where they had no representation, operating with or without royal charter. This group sought liberty. They were liberals looking for freedom. And when it became clear that a war needed to be fought, they needed a variety of gifts, from the battlefield strategies of a person like General Washington to later the peacemaking negotiation skills of a diplomat like Ben Franklin. But the imaginative creativity that was needed to capture the hearts of the people, to believe that they were indeed a people, required sharp and clear speech of a man like Thomas Paine. Some people can be reasoned into sense, Paine says, and others must be shocked into it. Say a bold thing that will stagger them, and they will begin to think. Paine's own life story may illustrate his conviction that a democratic society, a free society, a liberal and liberating society is necessary for the development of each human being. Paine was born in the village of Thetford, England, a community of 2,000 inhabitants, where 31 people were eligible to vote for Parliament. 2,000 inhabitants, 31 eligible to vote. The class distinctions of inherited titles and land, the income requirements and gender distinction for suffrage create a system that none of us would see as anything like free. In a time when a minor duke or duchess could expect an income of perhaps £10,000 per year from their estate, Paine's family business of making corset stays for ladies' undergarments produced an income of about £30 a year, which, by the way, was a lot of money, much more than someone would get paid for being a hand, even a skilled hand on a farm, or being a teacher, who might make £10 a year. So this family made £30 a year, but it was far less than the more than £40 a year required for anybody who wanted to vote. Participating in the community by voting was an act that was denied. And in terms of Paine, it was doubly denied, because Paine had an unacceptable religion. No, Paine was not a Universalist. Paine was not a Unitarian. While his mother attended the Anglican Church, his father was a Quaker. And Quakers could not be trusted to be able to make decisions for the larger society. Quakers would not serve in the military. Quakers would not swear oaths in court. Quakers would not doff their hats to magistrates. They would not address anybody with any noble titles. They named both commoner and noble thee or thou. Quakers and other dissenters, including Unitarians, were allowed the freedom to worship eventually, but they were excluded from voting. They were excluded from public service. They were excluded from entering university. Coming to America in the years before our revolution began, Thomas Paine became the plain-speaking man, the sharer of common sense, the bold voice that helped our people begin to see ourselves as a people. Not subjects, but citizens. Not colonists, but a country. Paine called it the United States of America, and it seems to have stuck. This voting act was a religious act, because the Quaker belief insisted that the norm for living was not the Bible, which they read and studied and respected, but did not deify. The norm was the evidence of the natural world and the divine spark that they believed existed in every person. The divine spark in you, speaking to the divine spark in me, with us reflecting together on this natural world that we inhabit and experience together. That's what gives us any kind of entry into noble and eternal truth. This author of the most widely published treatise in the world of his day, The Rights of Man, which had been published in hundreds of thousands of copies, distributed throughout Europe and the United States in English, French, Dutch, German, and even, thanks to the Unitarian College in Transylvania, in Hungarian, this author argued that no book could contain solitary truth. The Muslims might revere the Quran, the Persians their Zendavesta, the Jews their Torah, and the Brahmins their many holy books, but humanity had no shared text but the natural world, an increasingly large and complex universe that argued against any revelation that asserted that the God who created millions and millions of worlds, and they were beginning to see a larger and larger cosmos when the planet Uranus was discovered. Suddenly the solar system was twice as big as it had been. This expanding idea about the world that we live in. If anyone asserts that God has somehow said this planet is number one, or that this religion is number one, it makes no rational sense. The divine in me speaks to the divine in you, and we inhabit this natural world, and we look for the laws and the ways of being that emerge from our shared experience. Paine wrote a creed that speaks very directly. I believe in one God and no more, and I hope for happiness beyond this life. I believe in the equality of man, and I believe that religious duties consist of doing justice, loving mercy, and endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. This credo, this religious sentiment, is likewise a political sentiment. We exist in equality. We together carry the costs and joys of creating the liberal and liberating society where that equality that exists might actually be known with happiness and mercy and justice. We carry these costs and joys with thanksgiving. Still, I will carry a sadness with me this week in our sacred civic work, a sadness that there are forces in motion which would limit the access to the act of voting to many people. Unnecessary laws to protect voting make it more difficult for people to exercise their rights. When we deprive the vote to those who have been incarcerated, we diminish the value of their having done their time, paid their debt. When we dissuade those for whom the purchase of a government ID presents a significant financial hardship, we recreate the bad old days of poll taxes and civics examinations. This is contrary to the intention of Paine and other founders of our imperfect and evolving democracy. I will carry another sadness this week. About half of us who have the right to vote will not do so. Our inability as a theologically liberal people to elevate the value of voting is a statement about our values and our commitment. It's up to us to address the cynicism of people in general and the attitude that my vote doesn't count. It's up to us to be clear about our assessment that each person is valued, that each person has worth and dignity, and that every voice contributes to the decision-making in our liberal and liberating society. It's up to us to convince people that their participation is essential if we are ever going to live up to our collective promise as a nation. It is the demand of us, and of our liberal religion that we meaningfully engage others in the public arena, because voting for us is like a religion. My first experience of voting was a disaster. I still feel a redness in my face when I think of my losing battle with that ancient machine. But I have never missed another election, never missed a by-election, never missed a partisan primary or a non-partisan preliminary vote. I have exercised the franchise, sometimes holding my nose. I have taken seriously the expression of public will that elections reveal, even to the point of being unwilling to say, that son of a something or other president is not my president. Of course he's my president. I didn't vote for him. I'm not happy with the policies. But I participated in the determination of public will, and that guy won it, by hook or by crook. I take seriously the expression of public will that elections reveal, and I continue to participate in non-electoral ways to persuade and convince and move the representatives elected to office toward doing justice, toward loving mercy, toward endeavoring to make our fellow creatures happy. It's about voting, you see. It's my religion. It's my religion.